Splendid. Well, good afternoon to you all. Welcome on behalf of the IET. We have Edith and David who are joining us here. Session is promoted by the IET in terms of the technology and the working groups that we have in the UK here. We've talked about the journey. Are we nearly there yet? And the answer, as we've seen very clearly, is yes and no. So it's quite a long journey, and what we've got is a few observations about that journey, some suggestions, which we're going to pull together from some of the learning that we've got within the IET, and we'll share those with you as we go. Firstly, we'd like to just... This is the agenda we're going to run through. We'll introduce the IET just very briefly. We've got a banner over there on the right, and we have Anna here at the front. So we'll tell you a little bit about that just very briefly. But as far as the technical input, we're going to spend some time talking about autonomous systems, looking at lessons that come from the rail industry and the aero industry, and compare and contrast them. There are clearly similarities and there are some pretty clear differences as well, but it's interesting to observe those and see what we can learn from that. And then we're going to talk about advanced to automated. Edith's going to lead that. Edith's from Jaguar Land Rover. She'll introduce herself in due course. And then David's going to talk about implementing the challenges of highly automated systems. He's already introduced himself, so there we are. So that's the agenda that we're going to take ourselves through for this last session this afternoon. So in terms of the IET, it's the Institute of Engineering and Technology. The mission that we have there is to engineer a better world. So it's the Institute of Engineering and Technology. So this is all about doing stuff. And clearly here, one of the focuses is on transport. And clearly we're going to be talking about that which is relevant to autonomous. But the IET is all about engineering. It's about supporting technology. It's about supporting innovation. And we need all of that to be able to deliver what we need for autonomous driving. So with regard to working to engineer a better world, how does the IET go about doing that? Well, it has a number of themes that it follows in order to be able to do that. These are the five key planks that the IET works through in order to engineer a better world. On the left, we have there with regard to public relevance. And we've talked already today about influencing the public in different ways. Clearly, conveying to them why autonomous vehicles are necessary, why they're important, what the benefits are. So there is a public relevance theme to the work that the IET does with regard to the economical benefits in terms of fuel economy, the safety, the transport capacity issues that there exist, and with regard to the convenience and the benefits that result. So there is a communications dimension to the work of the IET. Clearly, in terms of engagement, we need to engage, and we do engage with legislators, with government, with industry, and with academia, so that we're able to influence in all of the appropriate ways that are necessary. And then on the right side here, in terms of the actual engineering and getting the knowledge and growing that knowledge, we've seen how long it takes with the life cycle of a vehicle. There's going to be a lot of younger engineers who are going to be coming up and growing into this industry as the only industry they've ever known, whereas some of us have been around for a little while and have seen it develop. So in terms of developing engineers, for both students and young professionals, growing the knowledge, and in terms of promoting professionalism, it's absolutely clear that some of the software techniques that have typically been used in the sometimes less secure IT industry, although we've clearly heard of the lessons that are being learnt there, that there's a different order of magnitude of integrity required here. So in terms of the professionalism that's needed, getting the right qualified people to support the industry is absolutely critical. And this is the summarising here, the work of the IET. Some numbers for you. The Institute of Engineering and Technology has some 160,000 members spread across 150 countries. So it's a global organisation. Although it might be based in London, it's very global. It awards prizes to encourage innovation and development. There's over £1 million worth of prizes and awards and scholarships are made. And there's a very large social media following, particularly with regard to some of the material that's produced by the IET. There's the IET videos on YouTube and on IET TV, which is all part of influencing and educating people. That's the IET itself. What's it doing with regard to automotive? Well, let's talk about transport for a little bit. There are a number of IET sectors in which we work. The one that is presenting today and is involved is clearly the transport sector, and it covers the four key areas of aero, of rail, of marine, and obviously of automotive. And by linking those together within the IET, within the IET transport sector community, we're able to bounce ideas off each other, compare and contrast, and we'll be doing a little bit of that this afternoon. The other aspect that we do touch on, there are other sectors with information and communications, clearly very important as we've explored with the cyber security. So there's a very hard link there. Design and production and energy, these are all related topics. The built environment is a very important one, again, that we have links with within the transport sector, so that the vehicles that we want to operate, clearly they have to operate within a context, and that context is the built environment. So making sure that the built environment, as it is built, is suitable and where possible and where relevant, is designed obviously for road safety, but with the advent of autonomous vehicles is going to be designed so that it can support and make life easier for the autonomous sensing systems there. So these are the key areas that we're actually looking at here. So within the IET transport sector, drilling down into there, there are a number of five key areas that we're looking at. Autonomy is one of the themes that is clearly very important and hence our presence today. Cybersecurity we've touched on, clearly linked in there with communications, and the storage and acquisition of data and the distribution and dissemination of that are critical. It's not particularly our theme for today, but energy is another one. The IET within the transport sector across the patch has looked at the electrification of transport, again across the marine, the rail, the aero and the automotive industry. But that's not our theme for today. Clearly top of the list for today is autonomy. Now, with regard to autonomy, we're going to talk a little bit now about lessons that can be learned from the rail industry and the aero industry, just to touch on that. With regard to the rail industry, there has been for a long time automatic train protection. So safety has been key to the rail industry. The dangers of overrunning signals is self-explanatory. Sadly, it's been done for many years with horrible consequences. But ATP, as automatic train protection, is something, if you like, as a safety system. This has been available now for quite some time. And it's clearly looking at the vehicles, the rails, vehicles target speed, and then either provides warnings to the driver, should the driver not take any notice of that, then automatic braking then can be introduced or a speed restriction applied at that point there. So the system is taking into account the speed and position of the train relative to its position on the track and then issuing warnings and applying the brakes. In many ways, that's exactly what the auto industry is now doing with forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking. But there's clear parallels there with what is already actually in place. And that's been around for a good long while within the rail industry. What has been developed in the recent past is automatic train operation, ATO as they refer to it. And it's really interesting actually to stand back and say, well, why has automatic train operation been introduced? And within the rail industry, the key driver has been capacity, track capacity. How many trains per hour can you get down a given line? And so with regard to that, although you can use automatic train operation to tune a rail network for its more ecologically friendly driving style of the trains, that is largely at the moment not the way it's tuned. It's tuned largely towards maximising track capacity. We've got an example for you there that it's clearly found more frequently on the metro and on the underground lines within the UK for sure. An example we can quote is the London Victoria line, where the technology for automatic train operation was being considered, and it was thought a good idea to keep drivers in the loop, at least maybe for 15-20% of the time. But it was not possible. Even with the best trained drivers that were there, it was not possible with drivers actually driving trains for only 15-20% of the time to get the required track capacity. With the best drivers there, they could increase the capacity up to about 15 trains per hour. But with full ATO, you could boost that a significant distance, bringing it up to something like 30 to 33 trains per hour. So it's all about track capacity, and it needed full ATO to be able to get that, to get the right reaction times that are necessary. Drivers on their own just could not achieve that. And then when we figure that back into the automotive industry and in the vehicle side of things, that's an interesting thing to bear in mind as a key lesson from the rail environment. The architectures that are used are, I think we'd recognise actually, although the lettering on here, we'd probably recognise a lot of this from the automotive. We obviously have a vehicle, and there is the ATP, the train protection around it. So there would be a model of what the train should be doing, monitoring its actual behaviour, and then being able to apply a stimulus on the front to be able to protect it should anything become abnormal. We might draw different shape and size boxes and different colours, but in essence, those kind of protection mechanisms are well known and understood in the automotive industry. On the control side, well, either you can have it controlled through the HMI and a driver, so that the driver has manual control, or in parallel and or taking over, you can have the ATO system that's now issuing controls to the train. And again, that can and does work very nicely. Maybe the different dimension here is the traffic management system that is clearly built into these things. There is a timetable that is sequenced and scheduled, and it is controlled from central control points. And that clearly is a very significant departure from the way in which drivers behave totally or autonomously to themselves without any central control, clearly, in the automotive environment. So that box on the right, with its communications here, which may be frequently by radio links, that is a fundamental difference. So in terms of achieving capacity, that is a key element to rail traffic management that is not present, really, at the moment in the automotive industry. Within the rail industry, there's some key standards that are followed. I'm not going to go through them here, but they are there. These are the EN numbers in the rail industry, and these are very prescriptive about the specification and demonstration of reliability. They're very prescriptive about the software and the way it's homologated, and they're very prescriptive, likewise, about the safety-related designs with regard to the safety case. So it's very stringently controlled there. It's highly regulated, and there are authorities as well. These are, obviously, we're not going to list them all for the world here, but these are two of the key ones. In the UK, we have the Office of Rail Regulation, clearly across Europe, and it's been useful to harmonise a lot of the regulations. There is the European Railway Agency there. So the lessons there from the rail industry is that there's a very, very strong specifications and procedural approach to this, and it's a very highly regulated environment. So there's just briefly a few top-level lessons from the rail industry. With regard to the aero industry, the whole concept within the aero industry for safety within flight is the whole concept of see and avoid or sense and avoid. If two planes are on a collision course, it's absolutely imperative that there is an agreed protocol to avoid each other. The last thing you want is one turning right and the other turning left. The obvious disaster will continue there. So when two aircraft are approached, there are clear basic criteria with regard to both of them banking to the right. But far more than that, autonomous flight, it's interesting again to ponder why you would want to have autonomous aircraft. Safety and reliability are key contributors. Safety is non-negotiable in these areas here. Clearly, it's very visible. One of the problems for automotive is that it's not visible, and yet it can have horrible effects in greater numbers. But safety and reliability are very visible, so that's important. Fuel efficiency is something that aircraft are absolutely key to look at, because that's very key from the business case, but also clearly from the environmental perspective. But the other thing with autonomy in the aero world is that it offers previously unattainable mission capabilities, whether that's landing an aeroplane in fog where you can't see the runway until the last moment and yet it will auto-land, whether it's extending flight schedules beyond that which pilots would normally be permitted to do. So autonomy is there for aiding all of those things. And those can clearly have a direct analogy back into the automotive world. With regard to aerospace, the good news is that as far as autonomous flight is concerned, there's some inherent attributes that we like. They don't tend to suffer from memory loss, lack of concentration or boredom, which is a real issue on a long flight where the waypoints are maybe many, many miles apart. So that's a key point there. They react extremely fast to recover situations where there may be an issue. There are that the handover from automatic to manual in the case of a fault is something that is really, really critical to understand. If you look at the Air France flight that sadly crashed in the southern Atlantic, which had been flying from South America, that was an issue where there was a problem with the flight systems and the sensing. We won't go into the architectural details there. But the handover in a fault condition to a pilot who was not fully awake clearly had catastrophic problems there. So that handover from automatic to manual is something that's really critical. And if the automatic systems can handle it themselves, then that is far better. So again, more of a trend to full automation is to be encouraged from that. So there's a lot of lessons there that we can look at. As far as the architectures are concerned, I'm not going to give you a treatise on aerospace architectures at this point, but nonetheless, there is a flight management system which is accepting a flight path from the pilot. It will be programmed before the plane even takes off. It'll reference a number of systems that will be on the plane, and it calculates the course both vertically and laterally as well, so that's all computed before the aircraft even takes off, and it's implemented via the flight management computers. There will be a minimum of two of those, and maybe many more. Some systems are quadrupled. And then, once you're actually in flight, there's the autopilot itself. For some reason, it's always called George. But anyway, George is the autopilot. George will obviously then carry out the actual operation of the flight surfaces and the throttles, and that does the business. So there's clear analogies there back to the way in which you would control the layers of control within an autonomous vehicle. This would be the lower level stuff, and then we've looked at the higher level stuff. As far as standards are concerned, there are, again, very, very prescriptive standards. Standards that are very interesting. Firstly, look at them. There are software ones that are referred to. There's design assurance. And then there's process points as well to consider with the particularly with the development guidelines for civil aircraft, and there are guidelines for conducting safety assessments there. One of the problems that the aero industry is actually dealing with at the moment is that there are these standards that are in place, and there are some very strong certification agencies as well. Within the FAA and the ESA, very strong certification. These agencies themselves are at the moment having the real problem that the systems are becoming so complex that they are tending to push more and more back to the suppliers to do the analysis, to provide the results of that analysis for them to actually just review and certify rather than actually doing some of that themselves. An example of where some of this may be starting to break down as a suggestion is the problem with the lithium-ion batteries within the Boeing 777, where the FAA were at that point the American authorities there, they were unable to actually have spent so much time doing the review, and they trusted, probably over-trusted, the information that they had been given, assuming that the suppliers had already done that for them. And there's a big lesson there. Clearly, even in a majorly regulated industry like the aero industry, for things to creep through the net, there are problems there. In the automotive industry that is in no way regulated in anywhere near the same way, to push back and to leave the suppliers to do the verification is something that we should talk about and discuss the appropriateness of that, because the complexity will just as much. So in summary then, we see that there are some similarities in terms of the rail, the auto and the air industry. Clearly there is a trend there in terms of the objectives. Everybody wants increased safety across all of these industries, and it's good to collaborate and to be reflecting on that. It's good as well to look in all of these areas to see how we can maximise transport capacity. And these are common themes there. There are also common themes with regard to the control and processing architectures, the idea of multiple parallel independent systems for sensing, controlling and monitoring. However, the automotive industry, of course, we'd love to have quadrupled and quintupled systems to give us the reliability. There's absolutely no way that that is affordable. So the automotive industry is always going to be looking to see how an acceptable level of safety can be achieved with duplicated and then maybe triplicated systems in some cases. But nonetheless, there are lessons there that we can look at for commonality. The main challenges with regard to the automotive industry is that it's a totally uncontrolled operating environment. The rail industry is highly controlled. It's most unusual to find somebody else on your tracks that you didn't expect to be there. The aero industry has always in the past been highly controlled, and within air traffic control corridors still is. But with the advent of UAVs and drones appearing, there are now rogues in those areas that you need to take a look at. So it's maybe something that the aero industry is struggling with, but the automotive industry, absolutely. Anything can happen and anything does happen on the roads. And so that means, therefore, that the superior sensing requirements absolutely have to be developed within the automotive area to the right level of integrity. The other thing that clearly rail and aero industries have a lot of is vehicle to infrastructure comms, clearly with the rail industry to the track control and likewise to aero control. That's something that we don't have the concept of that, but if we want to push capacity to the kind of limits that's necessary, then maybe an increased amount of vehicle to infrastructure comms may be necessary to squeeze that level of capacity out of the infrastructure. And at the moment, we have no mandated agencies, really, for external certification. We've seen with regard to emissions on diesel vehicles, that's already a bit of a challenge that needs to be looked at. And clearly, with these high integrity systems, that's something that really needs to be looked at, the procedures and the protocols and the authentication of that. So that's where the IET transport sector is able to look across these areas and draw lessons, draw comparisons, compare notes together. But specifically now, we're going to invite Edith to come forward and to describe, particularly from a car perspective, the views that are seen from that.
Hello, my name is Edith Holland. I'm the lead functional safety engineer at Jaguar Land Rover in our electrical, electronic and software engineering department. This is located within the product development part of the company, so I'm actually accompanying features we're working on cars that are coming up in the near future, so not the research area. I'm going to talk about functional safety from an OEM point of view, and these are the topics I'm going to cover. So as I said, I'm going to talk about BUST Level 0, 1 and 2 systems, which is what we're currently working on in the context of ISO 26262, which is the functional safety standard for the automotive industry. I'll give a brief outlook of challenges and roadblocks I envisage in as we move on to BUST Level 3 systems, but more will be covered by Dr. David Ward's presentation next, and then a quick summary to finish. There are obviously different approaches are being taken by different companies. We've touched upon the different scales that are available for this glide path towards full autonomy, BIST, NHTSA, SAE, and they're all progressing towards this full autonomy, which is obviously the big goal we're all here to talk about, by gradually adding more assist functionality, and these features are covering different scenarios and different use cases. The alternative approach is obviously, as the picture should show, what Google have done, aim straight for full autonomy. At Jaguar Land Rover, we are currently working on various ADAS features on different BUST levels, but as a vehicle manufacturer, our customers expect new content every year. It's obviously one way of retaining our customer, making them buy another of our products, and ADAS features is currently one of the main ones driving vehicle purchases. On the other hand, as an OEM, we still have to consider that at the moment a lot of our advertising is still aimed at the driving experience, lights, camera, drive. So obviously the take on the lights, camera, action. At the moment, it's an action. It's a driver experience. And so we are still trying to find the way, the best way forward. What is it the customer wants? Our other brand is obviously Land Rover with its go anywhere attitude. That's even more difficult. How do we sell an autonomous car for something that's got such a driving experience marketing strategy behind it? Just as a quick overview, these are some of the... There should be a little video there highlighting one of our ideas. Oh, yeah. These are some of the ADAS features that we've got out there in the market. As you can see, they're still bus 0 and 1 features. Our bus level 2 features are still in development. But they are all, hopefully, that's our intention, currently in line with our brand values and adding safety and comfort to our customers. But moving on to functional safety a bit more, I think as we've heard today already, at the lower end of this scale, the assumption is always that the driver is still in control. And that's what functional safety, what we've based all of our safety concepts on so far. So if we've got failures, functional safety deals with malfunctions of electrical equipment. If we've got failures and need to maintain a safe state, normally we'd go to switching something off or a reduced level of performance. So, for example, for an EPAS system, if we've got a malfunction, we'll switch the electronic part off, falling back into mechanical or hydraulic backup systems. For driver assist systems, it's usually off completely, with the expectation that the driver can handle the situation. But was mentioned in a comment already, if the driver's actually expecting a system input, a deceleration that is not there, it might actually lead to some undesirable behaviour as well. But, we deal with this as part of a safety life cycle in our development. This is prescribed, maybe not the right word, but this is described in the ISO 26262 standard. We do safety analysis activities. We define what the hazards are that a feature or an item can have, and then derive safety concepts that aim to address these hazards through detection of relevant failures and transition into these safe states, as I said. These safety concepts are then implemented as part of the development process in hardware and software, and then coming up the right-hand side, validated. This diagram is just showing how, in the BAST Level 2 systems, how we are looking at the cooperation between the driver and the system. So the driver performs longitudinal or lateral control, and he might have, for a BAST Level 2 system, so we've got longitudinal and lateral control assisting him. For a BAST Level 1 system, it would just be one of these lanes. If you've got any malfunctions in the system, the safety concept would address this and deal with it and put the driver firmly back in control. In a later slide, I'll highlight how this will change as we're moving up to higher autonomy systems. What does it mean for software? The software will implement some of the safety requirements that are part of the safety concept. And In the function safety standard, ISO 26262, the random failures in hardware are addressed differently to the software failures, which are normally seen to be systematic failures. The correctness and integrity of the software is assured through a robust software development process, and that is defined in ISO 26262, dependent on the ASIL of the hazards we're dealing with. So the aim of all this is that the software requirements should be as complete as possible and then implemented correctly. And with this, we hope to have our argument that we've achieved the required level of safety. Another aspect we need to consider is, as we are adding these safety features, as I've touched upon, with the driver needing to be back in the loop, so we're hoping that any failures can be dealt with by the driver. The problem is that these ADAS features address very specific driving scenarios, and how we can make it obvious to the driver in which area he's currently operating in is something that increases the considerations. So HMI is becoming a lot more important for safety. For higher level bus systems, software functionality needs to include some of the current driver functions. I think David is going to touch upon safety of the intended function as well. This is something that ISO 26262 is working to include in its next edition. But software verification requirements are expected to be more rigorous as well. At the moment, we know how to deal with the control algorithms, how we can validate those. But the new algorithms that are expected that deal with how to detect the objects, what to do if you detect an object, how to plan the path, and when will be confidence to say that we've done enough to consider it safe is something that we're still working on. Fail operational requirements will come in as well. That, I think, hasn't been touched upon, although Mark's mentioned it a bit. It's something that the rail and aeronautical industry have got more experience with, so we're hoping to learn from that as well. This is now contrasting the diagram that I've shown earlier. So for bus level 2 systems, as you can see, it becomes an either-or. So it's either the driver or the system that is in control of the vehicle. So the safety concept of switching off the system doesn't work at all times. And in addition to the safety concept, that needs to make sure that the driver is back in the loop and ready to take over when the system cannot deal with it. It's this aspect, as I said, the safe functionality at all times that needs to be defined. How safe is safe enough? These are just a few key words that I want to mention to start the discussion off. In order to move up towards autonomy a bit more, there are certain aspects of software, capability or also software development that will need to be addressed. Software will become non-deterministic. I think self-learning and artificial intelligence has been mentioned earlier on as well. From my point of view as a safety engineer, how do I then argue that the system is safe enough if I haven't got a standard that allows me to use software in this way? How can I argue that my verification has been acceptably covers what's required? And this will all feed into my safety case to say that this autonomous system or partial autonomous system is safe enough. Hopefully that's given you a quick overview from an OEM point of view, what we're dealing with in functional safety as we move up towards autonomy, and some of the challenges that I still envisage are coming. And with that, I want to hand over to David.
Thanks, Edith. So Edith's given a view from an OEM perspective, what are the challenges, if you like, in specifying and the high-level design of the system. What I'd like to do is to pick up on that and talk about some of the implementation challenges of highly automated driving systems. It's quite interesting, if I kind of look at where my company's going, we're looking at how we can help people engineer vehicles that are safer, cleaner and efficient, but also at the same time to develop vehicles that are rewarding to drive and operate. And I think that those objectives we have in our engineering time very well with some of the things Edith was saying about the products that particular company makes, where the experience is very much part of it, and also what my colleague from the UK Department from Transport was saying at the beginning. But what we see is that functional safety and related disciplines of product integrity are a key enabler across all of these objectives that we have for vehicles and transport. And although the work that I'm involved with and the work that Edith's involved with is often called functional safety, I think it's increasingly clear that that's just one part of achieving integrity of the products that we're delivering and that we're developing and delivering. And even a standard like ISO 26262 for functional safety builds on existing well-established principles of systems engineering and reliability engineering in the automotive industry. But it's clear that we face new challenges to deliver safe and secure, highly automated features, including both addressing cybersecurity, as we've already seen earlier today, and also the availability or fail operational characteristics. So we very much need a broader approach than just focusing on what's traditionally called functional safety. And indeed, if we look at some of the assumptions in the approach that's in ISO 26262, I've just listed here a number of key assumptions or a number of key, if you like, presuppositions about the way 26262 is developed and applied, many of which contrast with highly automated driving. I think we've already picked up on most of those themes today in earlier presentations, but it is just worth commenting again about, for example, the fact that 26262 is concerned with hazards caused by malfunctioning behaviour, but now we have to consider the intended functionality and also the way that drivers interact with the systems, the possibility that if, for example, the HMI is confusing, that the driver may cause unintentional operation of the system. We have to consider the reaction times for the driver to take over. We have to consider how we move from a deterministic approach to software development to things like machine learning. ISO 26262 was published in November 2011. It basically sets out the way that we design, implement and validate systems, hardware and electronic systems, their hardware and software in the automotive industry. And there's already a number of activities underway to look to extending that towards Edition 2. But if I had to say, are we nearly there yet in terms of autonomy in 26262, I'd have to say I don't think we will be by Edition 2. We're starting to recognise things like safety of the intended functionality, some recognition of the needs for things like fail operational architectures, but I think there's still more work to do. I'd just like to pick up on one of the things that Edith was talking about, which is how the driver interaction changes as we move from a level 2 to a level 3 system. And I've just shown here a slightly more formalised model as a SysML model of how we might, for example, capture the driver interactions with a more highly automated function. And you probably won't be able to read that, and that's quite intentional because I didn't intend you to take this away from here. here as an exemplar, but what I just wanted to get across is that we need to start to think about modelling in more formal ways, the way that the system behaves, the way that the driver interacts, what happens in terms of the driver behaviour, the level three function, some kind of fallback function. So if the system goes offline during those 3 minutes where the driver can be out of the loop, is there a fallback function to address that? And is there some kind of, there still probably would ultimately need to be some kind of safe state involving the driver. And I think what we see emerging from that is the possibility of a multi-layer approach to the way we do the hazard analysis and set the safety requirements. So looking at potentially parallel analyses, both the safety of the intended functionality and malfunction of the primary function, but also having to do a separate safety analysis of the fallback function and identifying the level of integrity that also needs to be developed to, so that we can then we can then define an overall safety strategy that deals with the various transitions through that SysML diagram that I showed you. And I've just shown here, the sort of typical approach we might follow for a level three system. So if the intended primary function is something like automated highway driving, we have to consider what is going to be our strategy if during those 3 minutes that we allow the driver to be out of the loop, one of the systems has a malfunction, such as the steering system. Do we try to complete the journey? Do we try to pull into a safe location? Do we try to stop the vehicle in a safe location or some other strategy, and we'll then end up developing a multi-layer approach to the safety strategy. Looking ahead to some of the solutions now, one of the things that's being considered in ISO 26262 Edition 2 is fail operational architectures. So in Part 5 of the standard, which deals with hardware, it's proposed to give some guidance on the type of overall structure of architectures. So the general principle is to have a number of redundant paths with some kind of output adopter. That's the formal term that's used in the standard, but it means some kind of voter or selector that decides which channel is the one that has control, and some kind of safety mechanism that controls the switching. And then there's a number of different solutions being considered. It might be some kind of hardware redundancy, it might be two or three way voting, or it might be some kind of degradation. We also talked about cybersecurity standards and the fact that we also need to develop those to align them with the other safety and systems engineering activities. Already talked about SAJ 3061. There's further work underway to develop that. So, for example, what is the Edith mentioned ASIL, which is the measure of how robust the implementation of electronic systems needs to be to achieve functional safety. What's the equivalent for security? What's the security integrity level? And that's one of the topics that started to be considered under SAE, but there's also, as I already mentioned, I think some proposals to also develop an ISO standard for cybersecurity. So the industry is very active. I think the final topic to mention, again to pick up on one of Edith's points, is the challenges we face with software implementation. Again, in Edition 2 of the standard, we recognise that a fail operational property can be one of the attributes attached to a software safety requirement, and that will influence the software architecture that we use. But some of the things that we're already seeing, and this is one of the things that I find people coming to me and saying about the software requirements in part six of the standard. First of all, they say, well, 26262 has a V model, but we want to use Agile or some similar development method for ADAS functionality. And there are some people who say, well, so that sort of approach isn't compatible with functional safety. I think the reality is that 26262 is actually quite flexible in that respect. It does allow us to tailor the life cycle so we can accommodate other development approaches like Agile or test-driven development, provided that when we come forward to the final approval of the product, that we have executed all of the all of the safety requirements, all of the safety relevant requirements of the 26262 software lifecycle process. Again, it's already been touched on the issue of the traditional approach in something like 26262 for embedded software development is concerned with a deterministic approach. So being able to predict the timing properties, the memory usage, the execution time of software in advance, and having confidence that it will always do that no matter what we throw at it. The thing I'm hearing a lot about at the moment is, well, we want to use machine learning in ADAS and autonomous systems. So how do we reconcile those? You know, how do we accommodate machine learning to, you know, for systems to be able to mimic driver performance, at least correct driver performance, and also to deal with malfunction. Mark mentioned the railway standards for functional safety, and they're derived from a generic standard called IEC 61508, and at the higher integrity levels that positively says don't do things like artificial intelligence. So how do we reconcile those two worldviews? And then if we come back to how we actually write the software, if you look at some of the methods we use for software development, some of the coding guidelines, some developers of ADAS already saying, well, the things that are in things like 26262 and the MISRA C guidelines are too restrictive. We'd actually like to use things like recursion, which, again, are frowned upon. Actually, one of the things that we've been working on in the context of MISRA C recently is that there's another new document that we're about to release called MISRA Compliance, and that sets out a robust framework for claiming compliance with coding standards and also how we manage deviations. The reality is, in an embedded system, you cannot 100% comply with all of the guidelines in MISRA C, because you'll always need some deviations for dealing with I/O, for example. But what we need is to encourage a structured and disciplined approach to that, so that you don't find things like I once found in a code review where someone had put a comment where they said, change this line to keep MISRA happy. And we've already talked, but I'll make no apologies for mentioning it again when we come to testing these systems, the tension between needing to test these systems in real-life environments to accumulate high mileage, high kilometres on these systems, but at the same time to deal with some of the cybersecurity challenges and the needs for quarantine and safe and secure environments. So, for example, in functional safety, there's an SAE guideline for on-road testing of level 3 and above systems, which doesn't explicitly refer to 26262, but effectively what it says is to consider a subset of the functional safety life cycles. And I think, if I'm honest, that's the sort of thing that I perhaps, if I'm allowed to say this for the purposes of promoting discussion, this is perhaps the area that I see missing in the UK guidance at the moment. We're very keen in the UK to promote on-road testing, but if I'm brutally honest, I'm seeing this aspect missing at the moment in the code of practice that we have in the UK. So I think, in conclusion, the automotive industry approaches to product integrity are already well established. We have well accepted principles of systems engineering, reliability and functional safety. Connected and autonomous vehicles bring additional challenges globally in terms of cybersecurity and the need to consider availability and fail operational behaviour, but also in the detail of the implementation, the types of architectures and the types of solutions that we can use. And I've given examples of some of the industry approaches to meeting these challenges, but in terms of the journey, are we there yet? No, I think we still have some way to go. So thanks for listening.
So that gives us the conclusion for the observations that we had for you there. We'd be happy to take any questions, as long as they're easy. Well, either we answered all your questions or you're all fast asleep.
And it was initiated by your remark that the UK code practice It should have a reference to the SAE and the ISO standards. So do you think that governments should be function as a kind of a gatekeeper in the approval process? Because when you look at Scandinavia, for instance, they say, well, we're not a competent body. We don't have this knowledge, and therefore we trust on the good name and reputation of the manufacturer or whoever is applying for registration. So, yeah. What's your opinion?
Well,
about
I think in outline the UK government's approach has been to have a light touch in just the way you've described, and I think as a headline that is entirely appropriate. They want to encourage this. We all want to encourage it because of the societal benefits it will bring, and it's seen as not wanting to overburden it with regulation. But I think at the same time, in a code of practice, we ought to be, if you like, gently reminding people that these are some of the standards and guidelines that are available. I think, and I think the reason for that is that often established manufacturers are well cognizant with that. They take them into approach, but I think we perhaps need to gently remind some of the new entrants, if you like, that these are important factors that you have to consider. Ultimately there is an entry ticket that's there to the automotive industry, and that entry ticket isn't there as a hurdle. It's there because ultimately we're dealing with a safety related consumer product. And what I really like the material that Mark shared about the fact, that sort of think people like train drivers and airline pilots are highly trained. They specifically practice what to do with abnormal situations. When we design electronic systems, we have to take into account a wide range of driver skills and abilities in the road transport industry. So there's much more responsibility on us as engineers to do our work, to think of the reasonably foreseeable scenarios, and again, that's all part of the professionalism that the IET stands for.
To give you a flavour for the kind of sort of fail operational, over the winter we were testing systems where you can have an automatic emergency braking system, which is clearly part of an autonomous system, it has to be capable of doing that, but in the middle of an autonomous braking event, if the brake system fails, then what do? Stop braking? That's a bad idea. Keep on braking? That may not be appropriate. So you actually need to be able to keep maintaining a braking event even if one of the braking systems has failed. And the change over time between one to the other has to be pretty swift. You're talking something like sub 200 milliseconds to be able to change over from one braking system to another if it fails in the middle of an auto emergency braking event. That's the kind of sort of analysis that you've really got to get yourself cognizant with. The rail industry does something different. So some of the timings for them are a little bit slacker. If the automatic train, if the ATO system, if the automatic train operation system fails, it'll change over to another hot system that is there. They give themselves three seconds to be able to do that. It feels like a bump in the track when it actually happens, but they've got 3 seconds to change over. But in the automotive, you need to be a lot swifter for some of the actual auto emergency braking systems to fail and still keep braking.
Yeah, and I think really that's at the heart of what I was
saying. Yeah, absolutely. That's a little example to illustrate, sort of focus the minds on the importance of it.
Yeah, I think that time scale is a really important thing as well.
Yeah. And ISO 262 is pretty good at actually sort of defining the sort of the requirements for doing hazard perception testing to figure out what are the acceptable times. So that's a pretty reasonable framework to work within. Question at the back there.
Hi. As I understand it, ISO 26262 in its current form is highly deterministic, in that you have to, anticipate hazards and then, define the associated risk, in terms of severity and exposure and controllability. It seems to me that cybersecurity threats are inherently innovative, in that for some reason, and no one knows why, people will come up with ever more imaginative ways of, delivering malicious attack. And so how could a future iteration of ISO 26262 deem a system to be secure, in the same way that it currently deems the system to be functionally safe?
borrow a cliche, you're exactly right that with cybersecurity there is a big aspect of you don't know what you don't know. But I think equally as well there is a lot of knowledge available of typical threats, and the approach that that's why we very much advocate this twin track approach, to have a design led approach. So and what we typically do in the context of something like J3061 is we look at use and abuse cases. We sometimes call them dark side scenarios. So what are the who are the likely threat actors, what might they be wanting to achieve, and then we look at node information on, you know, the attack surface, the types of means that people might use to exploit, and then we borrow from well-established IT security principles to evaluate the likelihood of a successful attack based on the type of knowledge and access that people will require. So even in the IT security world, it's not as ill-defined as that. There are ways of assessing the risk and prioritising the actions, but we still need that sort of shared learning, that reactive approach to deal with the new things which emerge. And that's why I've said that really we need a defence-in-depth approach. So we can't just rely on securing the external attack surfaces, because once the inevitable zero-day exploit is found for something in the external interfaces, we also have to have means of protecting against that internally. But to be honest, some of that is what 26262 does anyway. When we design the software, we encourage defensive programming. Yeah. We think the unthinkable. We code in protections against things that in theory could not happen, because we know, you know, from a pure analysis of the software, you know, they may never happen. But if the hardware is affected, if there's a bit flip that changes the value in a variable, for example, then it's quite possible that variable that you thought could only take numbers between 0 and 3 in it suddenly has got 42 in it. And how is the software going to react to that in a defined way?
Absolutely.